Good afternoon, Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here with Thomas Hsu.
That's right.
Again, we're getting used to that. It's again, thank you to the Screen Actors Guild of America for allowing you to use your own name again.
Well, I may be doing this undercover. We're not sure yet.
Yeah, well, we'll cross our fingers. New time, 1 o'clock. How does it feel in there at 1 o'clock? It's bright out.
It's weird. I told you, I woke up this morning at 9 o'clock, looked at my clock, and said, oh, the show's over already.
Right. It's my fear. Ooh. I have every Saturday morning, actually. I wake up and the show's already over with. It's great to be here at 1 o'clock, our news time slot, and we're going to be... Chris, we have a great guest. Last week, he was a mystery guest because we did not have this confirmed. We were in tough negotiations all week, but we have Mike Binkley on today to talk about his days at Channel 5 and working at Channel 4 and the career before, during, and future. It's been a week of news. A couple of things I pulled out here. Big monumental birthday this week, and this turned 40. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Turned 40.
Turned 40.
No, I don't know.
April 3rd, 1973. Celebrate, and this is from Vanity Fair. Celebrate, get it? Okay. The 40th anniversary of mobile phone calls.
That's incredibly corny. I like it.
On April 3rd, 1973, from a Manhattan street corner, 6th Avenue between 53rd and 54th, we might get the exact location here, Motorola's Martin Cooper placed the world's first mobile phone call. To his rival, no less, Cooper called Joe Engel from Bell Systems to tell him that the race to perfect cellular tech was over. Motorola had done it first. Cooper's exact words on the call weren't recorded the way Samuel Morse's first telegraph message was, quote, "What hath God wrought," or Alexander Graham Bell's first phone call, "Watson, come here, I want to see you." He reportedly said something like, "I'm ringing you just to see if my call sounds good at your end."
Those are not exactly inspiring words.
It's, you take innovation and corporate raiders and you put them into the streets of Manhattan. This is what happens.
Well, I still would have liked it if they just said, oi, oi, like they originally wanted it to be the greeting on the phone.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Ahoy, ahoy. Right. There might be some people might remember that, that controversy, hello or ahoy, ahoy. Or if you watch The Simpsons, you might know that.
That's how I know. That's
too.
My education.
In fact, cell phones really weren't mainstream until probably about the early 2000s, but I found a video I want to play here. This is a news story from a outlet in Buffalo, New York, in 1986, talking about these new finagled cell phones. They look like, in the video, like two-pound bricks. And let's just hear a little bit about the cell phone technology of 1986.
It's a cross between a beeper and a car phone. It's a pocket cellular telephone, which Walker Telecommunications has recently introduced to the market.
Cellular really grew up in the need for people to communicate on the move, and basically this tied one to a vehicle. We really took a look at it and decided that there wasn't much sense to limiting that only to vehicular travel. So we set out to design and develop the world's smallest portable pocket cellular telephone.
There are only three portable phones available. The one on the left is put out by Motorola, the one on the right by General Electric. Walker's phone sells for almost $3,300 retail. The others are comparable at plus or minus $100.
We have, I think, a more fully featured product. We have such things as 99-number alphanumeric storage. We are 15 ounces, where the nearest competitor is probably over 2 pounds. We are much more convenient. We feel we can carry our product around in the breast coat pocket, whereas the rest require either a clip on the belt or a briefcase to carry the unit around.
The phone is a conglomerate of technologies from Switzerland, Japan, Holland, and the U.S. Walker Corporation estimates that the consumer price will drop to about $2,000 in 18 months or so from now. But at present, the demand is there.
This will run the gamut from...
Well, I hope that the price drops down to $2,000 next 18 months.
I like this thing. What is this magic brick? Magic device.
People need to talk to one another all the time. And the supermarket line, they need to talk to each other when they're crossing the street, when they're driving.
Oh, absolutely mandatory while you're driving. Try and take that away from me.
In 1986, $3,300 for the cell phone. In 2012, $2013, $6,800. So take a loan out, buy your cell phone, and then and call everyone nonstop. This is a commercial that was put up by Radio Shack, selling, again, these cell phones. And the price points, I think, are quite interesting.
Can I try it first, Mom?
Well, please.
All right.
A new generation of affordable cellular phones at an incredible price breakthrough from Radio Shack, the technology store.
Hi, Daddy, it's me.
And now there's a totally portable phone at a price we dare the competition to beat.
Yes, we can. Okay, be there soon.
Radio Shack, the first name in cellular telephone technology.
There you go. It's inspiring.
I want one right now.
You know what? I'll sell you one for $2,000. I will do that for you.
Somehow I feel like you're taking advantage of me. Well, how much was the Walkman that you talked about a few weeks ago?
I think the first Walkman? I think the first Walkman we found out was about $200, $300 price point, I think, when it first came out. And I think that we did the inflation calculator, and I think it was $500.
$500 or so?
We'll check the tapes and make sure I'm providing accurate information. Another sad event this week. So we had the monumental cell phone anniversary. Roger Ebert passed away, unfortunately, after a long battle with cancer. And this is from CNN. It was on the pages of newspapers and in the coveted aisle seat on televisions at the movies that the world met Roger Ebert, the passionate lover and sometimes combative critic of film who virtually defined cinema critique for a generation. But in his final years, when cancer had robbed him of his jawbone and whittled away his once ample frame, it was social media, particularly Twitter, that let Ebert not only keep talking, but also interact with his fans, foes, and more freely and personally than ever. This is a quote from Roger Ebert. "Twitter, for me, performs a function of running conversation," Ebert wrote in June 2010, about 8 months after he signed up for the site and 5 years after losing his vocal cords and part of his lower jaw to thyroid and salivary gland cancer. "For someone who cannot speak, it allows a way to unload my zingers and one-liners." Very sad that I'll be missing Roger Ebert's thumbs up. Siskel and Ebert are both gone. It's hard to believe, huh?
It really is, actually. I grew up with them, and, you know, I just enjoyed every single time I got to see them on TV. It wasn't often, but I loved it.
They were on Channel 5 for a long time. I think they were on Channel 9 before that here locally. And I always liked, when I liked a movie that Siskel and Ebert did like, I thought that I was intelligent. I thought that I was, thinking the same ways as these big Chicago film critics. Let's just play a commercial from their first show. This is a 1982 commercial for the new Siskel and Ebert at the Movies.
They should have watched our show. They should our show. Maybe you should watch our show. I'm Gene Siskel, film critic of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Roger Ebert, film critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. Our full-time job is going to the movies.
So join us this fall for At the Movies, the movie review program.
Saturday nights at 6:30 here on Channel 9.
There you go.
I mostly enjoyed their arguing. Those moments where you don't know if they're actually fighting, if it's a show.
That did happen once in a while.
Fairly often.
There's a few, if you go to YouTube, you can just YouTube Siskel and Ebert, and there are some of the best. There was a video I was going to play today that Siskel and Ebert were doing outtakes from a commercial they were doing. The tone might not have been appropriate for this week and some of the language we had to use our sensory squad for, but I encourage you to go to YouTube and type in Siskel and Ebert. There's some good stuff there. This is Flashback Twin Cities, and our guest today will be Mike Binkley. Let's take a break, and we will come back. Again, the email is flashback@klbradio.com, Twitter at TC Media Now, or check us out at tcmedianow.com for some of the videos we'll be talking about today. Let's take a break. We'll be back with Mike Binkley. Flashback Twin Cities, this is Tom Osman, and with me, Mike Binkley at WCCO TV Channel 4. Mike,
hey,
good
Tom.
Afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. This is our first show at 1 o'clock, and you don't do a lot of media after 12:30 too much, so
I have a marathon day. 12:30 comes, and yeah, I'm usually done for the day, but no, it's great to be here in Stillwater with you, too.
No, it's a great day. Always good to go to Stillwater, but especially on a nice... Is it bright outside still? I haven't...
It's getting better.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. The little spot I park is, there's still ice mountain there, but that'll be going away. So, now here's a question I've always wondered, people that anchor the news as early in the morning as you do. What time do you go to bed at night to get to do that 4 o'clock show?
I go to bed around 5:15 at night.
Okay,
hoping
right.
to fall asleep by about 5:30 because I get up at 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I can't fall asleep till about 6. But yeah,
is that tough? Is that tough to go to bed when the world is still running and there's
It's easier in the wintertime when the sun goes down earlier mm-hmm. than it is in the summertime when it stays up later. But when you do that schedule regularly, you kind of just change your life around and you get in the habit of doing that. I feel sorry for the people who have to fill in every now and then.
Right,
they come
right.
in and that's really, you know, freakish to them. But, you know, it's just my life.
Mm-hmm. And you've done mornings for how many years now?
Well, it was 7 years at KSTP, and then it's been a little more than 4 years at WCCO now.
Right, right. And you've been in the Twin Cities since 1986. And tell me briefly, before you came, you worked in Kansas and you worked in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, yep.
And where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Topeka, Kansas. So
okay.
I got my first job in my hometown, you know, so my family and my friends, who are very forgiving,
mm-hmm.
you know, were very thrilled to see me on TV. But yeah, I worked there about a year before I jumped to Cincinnati, and I worked there 5 years.
So you weren't satisfied being your hometown. You wanted to go to the bigger lights, the bigger city.
Yeah, well, Topeka, Kansas. I mean, it's a nice place to grow up, but yeah, I had bigger plans.
Sure. And so you got a job at KSVP, and did you send some tapes out, and then Channel 5 liked what they saw, or how were you focusing on Minneapolis?
I wasn't, actually. In this business, it's oftentimes who you know more than anything, and it just so happened that the former general manager for my station in Cincinnati came to KSTP, and he liked my work, you know, and so he said, you know, I guess I must have called him, and I said, my contract is up,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking to get out of Cincinnati. He goes, okay, I'll get you in touch with the news director.
Came to KSTP in, was it September of 86?
September of 86, yeah.
The General Assignment Reporter.
Yep.
And you were fortunate enough, but within about a year, to be anchoring weekends.
Right. It was a brief stint. They had an opening, and they put me on there, and it was fun. I was on there for 9 months, and I reached the point, though, where I said, you know what, I'm solo anchoring this show. I'm doing the job of an anchor. I'm still earning a reporter's salary.
Right.
What do you think? Can I maybe get a raise? And they said, I don't know, we'll just put somebody else on there.
You know,
that's part of the business.
It's hard about negotiation tactics. Well,
yeah.
Solo anchoring, that's a strategy that is long gone now. No one, you have at least two or three or four anchors at a show right now.
Right, yeah. And I'm glad of that.
And it's actually, I find it's very rare that someone actually would say, I don't want to do this anchoring job anymore because what's more challenging? Is it more challenging to be on the pressure of the camera and, you know, with the audience every day, or to do the general assignment reporting stints you did?
I would say each of them have their own challenges. I kind of consider myself as a reporter who does an okay job,
right.
you know, on
right.
the anchor desk or whatever. But, you know, deep in my heart, I think I'm a reporter. Being a reporter, you have the challenges of the deadlines and, you know, trying to get as much information as possible before
mm-hmm.
that deadline arrives, and then get it done, get it to the editor, you know, work with the photographer, you know, the logistics of getting around town and getting all the information that you need, you know, something that a newspaper reporter doesn't have to do because they
mm-hmm.
largely just sit there on the phone. So that is the pressure of being a reporter. But as far as the anchor, it's largely a popularity contest. I mean, you're trying to get people to like you, to
right,
believe
right.
you, to want to tune into you, you know, day after day. So being on, you know, especially as we are, 2.5 hours in the morning,
right.
you know, that's a challenge to be up and positive. You know, everybody's going to have bad days. But
right.
but the viewers at home don't care when you're having a bad day. You know, you still have to bring it.
That's right. No, it's amazing. I was talking a little bit off air. The amount of hours that morning news goes on, and now even evening news, because the duopolies now, and stations, you know, station companies own three or four stations in a market now.
Right.
You know, there's a couple of them here in town. You finish your first stint, and then you go to the second channel, and you're doing another newscast.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe niched a little bit closer to your demographic you're reaching for at this station this time, but that's a lot of news out there. And if you think about it, in 86, you know, CNN had not matured yet.
Right.
CNN was on cable. We didn't, I think it wasn't until the Gulf War that people really took to CNN as a credible news source. It was
mm-hmm.
there, and they were providing good content. But now we look at how many, you know, commercial stations here in town, and plus we have four or five cable news stations right now. There's a lot of news out there, plus Facebook, Twitter,
oh, yeah.
The newspapers online. It's
mm-hmm.
a lot of news content out there.
Well, and that is what has really shrunk the budgets of news departments. We're not doing the traveling that we
mm-hmm.
used to do. You know, we don't have the reach, so we do have to kind of specialize a little bit more. You know, there are good and bad things about that, but yeah, we definitely have a lot more competition than we've ever had.
Let's talk about those early days of KSGP. You come from Cincinnati and compare the Cincinnati market to the Twin Cities market. Was it, I don't know the ranking of it right now between, I think it's a little bit smaller than Minneapolis.
Yeah, Cincinnati is about the 30th largest market, okay. And Twin Cities is 15th.
Did you feel a little overwhelmed? Did you feel like, wow, this is in the top 15 markets now? This is,
A little bit. And it was so great to see Stan Turner here at the station as I was just arriving. And he and I had a chance just briefly to reminisce, but we were talking about how that time when I arrived, the mid-80s to the late 80s, we really hit the top of the wave right mm-hmm. then. And mm-hmm. actually, KSDP was the place to be. Stanley right. Hubbard, you know, with just all the pioneering in technology mm-hmm. and satellite broadcasting mm-hmm. that he did. It was at that moment that we were just starting to be able, as a local station, to be able to go live from anywhere, not just in the state right. or in the country or in the world. I think in my first few months when I arrived there, Jason Davis had just finished doing some live reports from the North Pole.
That's right.
And so we had the technology. It was invented in our backyard, mm-hmm. and we wanted to show it off. And we had the much bigger budgets back then to travel. So if there was a big story to go somewhere, we were going to go there. We weren't just going to depend on the network. You know, and quite often we could find a Minnesota angle while we were out there. But I went on a lot of really big stories in the mid to late 80s.
We'll talk about those in a second here. Just to talk about Stanley Hubbard, a lot of you know, there's mixed press, you know, when things happen in business and people get mixed perceptions. But Stanley Hubbard is not in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame, by accident. He innovated a lot of technology and a lot of way news is gathered in the country right now, a lot of model for satellite news gathering. And Dennis Felgen has a great story when he was called in the office and this is Stanley E. Hubbard comes into the office, says, This thing, and he looks at the magazine, it's a Doppler radar. It had not been invented yet. And he said, well, I'd love to buy one, but it's not invented yet. And within about a year, a truck rolled up to KSDP studios with the first Doppler radar.
Right.
6 months later, a tornado flew right over the station, though, and the Doppler didn't catch it. But that's well, it's bound to happen sometimes.
Yeah, seriously. But no, he's definitely a visionary. He was always, you know, wonderful to me. I have the highest respect for Stanley Hubbard.
This is Flashback Twin Cities. My guest is Mike Binkley. I'm going to play a clip here. This is from that 9 months of news anchoring, and this is a great story because the intro of the story kind of goes into some of the news events of the last few weeks here.
You're watching KSTP-TV, Minnesota's News Channel 5. Live from Minnesota's News Channel, KSTP Channel 5, Mike Binkley, Karen Falloon, and Mark Stevens bring you Eyewitness News.
More than 57,000 Minnesota Vikings fans packed the Metrodome in downtown Minneapolis today, a sellout crowd. But the Vikings aren't the only team that wants to play before Minnesota's enthusiastic crowds. Good evening, everyone. Minnesota and its Metrodome have a new reputation thanks to the World Series. Sports executives are finding they like what they see in the state, the fans, the dome, and the cities. As Pat Mylan reports, Governor Perpich is taking aggressive action now to land championship events in Minnesota.
The Metrodome,
the Metrodome,
the stadium of the future.
Yeah, really.
Today.
I guess within a couple of months of the World Series championship mm-hmm. of 1991, or 87.
87,
yeah, that was
right.
The first World Series championship. And, people were still kind of uneasy, I think. But then when mm-hmm. they saw the hanky-waving fans, we really did put on a good show for the national audience.
You know, if the Strikers would have got a national championship, that stadium would have been cemented forever.
Yeah.
No, it's there's a lot of great dome stories. There's one, and you talk about this in the story. If you go to tcmedianow.com, that entire news broadcast actually is online. We were just experiencing the first dome collapse a few years before, and
right.
Flash forward 23 years, we had our second dome collapse.
Yeah.
And, won't even talk about the teams that played in the stadium. They might have had a few collapses too. But let's that first year, 86-87, there were some big events. The Twins won the World Series.
Yeah.
You were there the day they won the World Series. You were reporting live from the streets of Minneapolis.
Yeah, outside with the mad fan. I mean, there were people who came down just to be in that area of the dome. I think some of them were watching the game at Hubert's. You know, others were just kind of camped out with their radios, and they just wanted to be part of the party because, you know, Minnesota sports. I mean, how many championships can we celebrate?
Well, there's not very many that
there
can
haven't
think of
been that many. So I remember that they were mostly well behaved, but I do remember I was doing a stand up after the '87 World Series championship, and there was a man in a gorilla suit that was grabbing my tie, and that little clip I need to find that, Tom. I'm still looking through my stash of tapes.
I like a challenge. Yeah. We're gonna find it.
That made it onto CNN. I had people from other parts of the country saying, "I just saw a gorilla pulling your tie on outside the Metrodome."
You give me a clip, give me a challenge, I'll find it.
All right.
And we'll find that. Okay, so 651-275-1220. If you have the clip of Mike Binkley's tie being grabbed by a man in a gorilla suit, check your 1987 World Series tapes. Give us a call. That's great. And then a few months prior to that, the Superstorm, which just turned 25 years old this past year.
Yeah. That was, Tom, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to go through this big box of old VHS tapes. But that was one, we had a Twin Cities Live program where we were all kind of looking back on this big year of 1987. And it's helping me remember. Some of these, I have vivid memories of, others not so much. But, there's a point where I'm talking about how I got called in the middle of the night.
And we're all public service here. Why don't we just play a clip of that, that Twin Cities Live show?
It's fun being a news reporter, isn't it? Right in the midst of... speaking of being in the midst of things, Mike, because I you and Kevin both covered the storm, along with some of the other reporters, the great superstorm that we had.
Right.
Here you have a situation where a storm is going on, and all the media outlets are telling everyone, stay at home, don't go outside, it's very dangerous, don't walk in the water, a power line could fall into it, you could get electrocuted. And where do we find Mike and Kevin but standing out in the middle of Highway 12 with water up to here? I mean, what's it like being in the midst of something like that?
Well, she had it the worst. But, yeah, me and my photographer were just talking about that the other day. When we were going on the air telling people, take cover, stay in your basements, take all precautions, don't go out unless it's absolutely necessary, we're the ones who are out there.
Let's go!
Yeah, exactly. On the day of the superstorm, that was my day off, and I was called in on my day off. And there you see some of the flooding victims coming out of their apartments. That was the worst rain that I have ever experienced in my life, and I'm driving in from Richfield, 20 miles away, and, concerned about whether I'm going to make it in. And as it turned out later on, I ended up being there the entire night, and as it turned out, I went home the next day and found out that the garage in my apartment complex had been completely flooded out. All the cars in there were completely totaled. So that was one time when I really said thank you to my assignment editor for calling me in on my day off.
I remember the shot.
I think that in Minnesota we like reporting on tornadoes, we like reporting on severe weather because it's such a part of what we talk about in the summer.
It is. There's a kind of a backstory with me too. Growing up in Kansas, kind of tornado alley. My home was hit by a tornado in 1966.
Wow.
And crazy enough, we did not have a basement in our home in Kansas, so we had to go across the street to these brick apartments. And sure enough, the sound of the train that everybody always describes, and the bricks flying in through the window wells, and the screaming people, and then walking out and not recognizing my neighborhood when we walked out. That had haunted me for quite a while. And I've been out, chasing tornadoes on storm coverage before, where some of that kind of comes back to me. I think I've mostly gotten past it. Now I find it kind of exciting. But yes, the storm coverage, the reporters do put themselves in danger sometimes. You try not to, but you got to get the story.
Was that the most dangerous story you've done, do you think?
That superstorm, the most dangerous storm? I'm trying to think. I know there have been times when hailstones have been pounding our car when we've been out. I guess I would have to say so. I know some other reporters have been, in much more precarious positions than I was on that night of the superstorm. But, yeah, it was quite dangerous.
There's some great video on tcmedianow.com, and there's about three or four reporters with large cameras, as they were in the day, wires coming into the water, hot microphones. It's amazing we didn't have stories the next day on reporters being fried, by their own equipment the next day.
Which, it happens. You're out there with a live truck, and to get the signal back to the station, you put up this large mast, which basically can become a lightning rod if you're there in the middle of a storm.
Right. So you did Superstorm and the Twins, and you took a step back from anchoring for a while, but then you went back to it. Tell me a little bit about that. You took a few years back in the reporting world, and then brought you back to do weekend anchoring.
Well, and really that was, my wife and I were just talking about, there was about the time that we got married, 1993, I broke my foot. And so I realized I wasn't going to be much, I wasn't going to be very mobile anymore. And I don't know whether this played a part in it or not, but the timing just seemed right that they put me on the weekend anchor desk. And so 2 days a week, I was just kind of sitting there doing my job. But then ultimately, about 7 years later, it must have been around 99 or 2000, then I was put on the morning anchor desk. And so that was 5 days a week of anchoring.
So tell me a little about the difference between doing the morning news and the weekend news and that transition.
I definitely like the morning news better because it's a more relaxed feel, but it does take a while because all my life I had kind of been the big J journalist, you know, mm-hmm, the top mm-hmm. story reporter and things like that. And here I am on the morning show, and they're wanting me to be more Mr. Personality.
We don't Rusty Gatenby with you. You have to be.
See, when you work with Rusty, that'll loosen you up a little bit. But it took me a while to not take myself so seriously. Mm-hmm. But that's the good thing about being on a morning show. I mean, you've got so much time to fill, but you also realize that people in their homes, they're just waking up and they don't want, you know, they don't want their morning filled with fires and murders and mm-hmm, things. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got to report the news, but they also want some lighter things that can help them get ready for the day. We realize they're kind of getting the kids off to school, getting breakfast made, that sort of thing. So we do have, we have a lot more fun on a morning show than you would on a traditional newscast weekday or weekend.
Is there a fine line where you can be too optimistic for the viewer at home? Like you said, they're just waking up. Some people don't respond so well to bright sunshine.
Be too cheery. Yeah. And then they haven't had their coffee yet, and here you are, Mr. Sunshine. I don't know. I guess we haven't heard too much of that. Every day we have this we have a morning show Facebook page where we kind mm-hmm. of give a little teaser of here's what's coming up on the show today. And, you know, sometimes we do like to put a lot of the light stuff, a lot of the fun stuff that we're doing there, and we'll see people will respond to that, and they'll say, what about news? You know, fluff. Well, you know, this isn't a complete lineup of everything we have in the show. These are just some of the fun things that you might want to tune in for. But, yeah, we try and strike that balance. We don't want to be too light, you know, but we also don't want to be too serious either.
Everyone's a critic.
Seriously.
I imagine that, and we were talking about Roger Ebert being able to connect with his fans on Twitter. There's got to be a lot more personal connection now you can have with your audience now mm-hmm. through Twitter and through Facebook and mm-hmm. through these other means. In I'm gonna call them the old days, but if you know years ago, did you get some phone calls and letters, and now that's transitioned to emails and transitioned to Facebook comments?
Yeah, I think we're a lot more accessible now than we used to be. I remember in the early days of email. You know, I'd give out my email address, and actually there would be people like, is this okay that I have this? Well, yeah, I mean, this is how you're going to get in touch with me now. But yeah, as far as the social media, it is very time consuming, as anybody knows who's, you know, part of Facebook or Twitter, but it really has become part of our job. Mm-hmm. Our marketing budgets aren't what they used to be, so this is free marketing for us. This, you know, we know how often people check their Facebook pages or their Twitter pages, and this is just kind of our chance to say, hey, you know, we're here. You know, this is what we're doing. Oh, look how much fun we're having. You know, look, this is why you should watch us, this is why you should listen to us. So yeah, we take advantage of that.
And you've anchored Angela Davis in two different stations, right? In two different stints now. Yeah. So how many years together with Angela Davis now?
I would say let me see, it was 6 years at KSTP.